ultimately, it's not the guns that determine power. It's the ideology that determines which way those guns are pointed.
You're listening to The Corbett Report.
Welcome, friends. James Corbett here at CorbettReport.com in a conversation that's being recorded on April 25th, 2016. And today we are talking to Dan Sanchez of DanSanchez.me. Link in the show notes, as always. He's an essayist and educator. He's also a contributing editor at Anti-War and an independent journalist for The Anti-Media. And, of course, we'll link both of those sites in the show notes as well. Dan Sanchez, thank you very much for coming on the program today.
It's nice to be with you, James.
Excellent. Well, I've been following your work for some time, but one article that particularly caught my eye was called "What If the Empire Held an Election and Nobody Came?" And this is a dream that I've had for for some time, as people might remember from my Anarcho-Poco speech, where that was one of the central conceits. And I think you articulated the idea here quite well, and I just want to read a couple of paragraphs that I think stood out in pointing out the ridiculousness of the four-ring sideshow circus that goes on every 4 years that people invest their identities in, where you say, imagine "Stop the War on Yemeni Babies" blazoned across the web instead of "Stop Hillary," or "Don't let the CIA arm Al-Qaeda in Syria" instead of "Don't let the establishment steal the nomination from Trump." An intense focus on policies over personas could really turn public sentiment against the actual combat of war and divert public attention away from its obsession with the theatrical combat of political WrestleMania. An excellent phrase, and I might steal that for future use. So let's talk about this idea and how it is that people have been brainwashed, indoctrinated into believing that personas are more important than policies.
Well, I think that's crucial for the power ritual that is what elections are. In another article, I have a number of other articles at the bottom of the article we're discussing, links to them. And one of them is called "Let's Boycott Hate Season." And in that article, I really talk about elections as a power ritual. And the personas are so important because they divert anger away from institutions. So I compare it to 1984 and the role of Big Brother and Goldstein. And so I make the point that every candidate serves the function as Big Brother to some in the electorate and as Goldstein to the other half. And so right now Trump is Big Brother to his following, but he's the Goldstein to a lot of the left. And you could say the same thing about Hillary Clinton or Bernie Sanders or any of them. And so basically people get so invested in this process and get caught up with these personas that they don't care anymore about the institution itself. In fact, they actually become more wedded to the institution of the state because their Big Brother, their champion against the Goldstein, is a state officer.
Yes. If we don't stop Goldstein, he might get into power. And that becomes the political calculus that a lot of people use in their 2 minutes hate. I think that's exactly right. It is the 2 minutes hate that goes on for several months in the lead up to every election every 4 years. In fact, it takes a year and a half at this point. So it is an effective way of diverting the public's attention. So let me play a bit of devil's advocate here and say, well, come on, Dan. People know that it's not you're voting for Hillary or Bernie or Donald. You're voting for their ideas. You're voting for a set of policies that they represent. So when you say "stop Hillary," what you're actually saying is stop, you know, all of the neocon policies and criminality that Hillary represents, right?
Well, for a lot of people, it really is about the personas and not about the policies. And so they become blind to certain policies that, for example, a lot of progressives become blind to the wars that Obama and Hillary have perpetuated. And a lot of conservatives become blind to their champions' flaws because it becomes a tribalistic partisan thing, and they're rallying around their ordained chief, and so they it becomes a strife of personalities instead of a contest of ideas, and it is true. So I have another article called "Trump Will Make His Peace with a War Party," where I make the point that even to the small extent that sometimes political ideas get raised in the election season, it's always a very debased level of conversation. Like the public discourse is very debased and crude. That really people are not actually considering the ideas and considering the arguments. They're just pretending to argue while they're just hurling invectives at their enemy opponents, and people just get so so caught up in the partisanship that their mind is not in a state in which it's willing to listen to reason. It's really in sort of a fight or flight warfare mode, and so I don't think that it raises the level of discourse at all.
I tend to agree. It just brings out the most tribalistic patterns in human behavior, which generally do not lead to productive discussion. I guess let's strike even further at the root of this. It's not just that the personas are the distraction from what's really going on and that people get too invested in that. It's that even the idea that if you can just pull the lever for the right guy or girl or team of people or party or whatever, if you just got the right people in power, they could wage the wars in the right way, in the right places, at the right time, and do the right things in, you know, when intervening in places around the world to make everybody happy, which is a fundamental error, which you talk about in your more recent article, The Pretense of Nation Building. Again, we'll put the link in the show notes, where you note that during his acceptance speech for the Nobel Prize in Economics back in 1974, Friedrich Hayek talked about the pretense of knowledge and what a problem that is for would-be central planners of the economy. And you talk about this as related to would-be central planners of foreign interventions. Let's talk a little bit about that idea, how this is fundamentally not just going to fail, but doomed to fail from its very inception.
Yeah, so really the war planners are just as much central planners as socialist planners are. And in Hayek's discussion, mostly he's talking about socialist planners, how they don't have access to local knowledge. Hayek talks about the complexity, the immense complexity of an economy, and how in order for it to function, it really needs to take into account all the details that only individuals on the spot have. And there's really no way in a central planning system for all those circumstantial details to be communicated to the central planner, and for the central planner to somehow integrate that all in order to plan the economy. Whereas in a market economy, the price system communicates those that local knowledge throughout the economy and integrates it into every market participant's decision by aggregating it into a simple signal that's called a price, and that can actually be acted upon by a mortal mind. Similarly, with central planning in terms of trying to centrally plan global security, which is really what these interventionists are trying to do. There's so much local knowledge that is relevant for the production of security and peace, which is what governance is supposed to be all about. Just as much as local knowledge is needed for the mass production of shoes or any other good or service, and so the central planners war planners are in the same predicament, and especially nation builders. So the neocons, and I also talk about the advocates of COIN or the counterinsurgency doctrine, how they also don't have the local knowledge, and so they make these ridiculous blunders, like I mentioned how they marginalized Muqtada al-Sadr in Iraq, and Muqtada al-Sadr is like a really important community leader. He wasn't just like, you know, some typical little petty warlord or anything like that. He was an important, if there was going to be some kind of order in Iraq, it had to involve Sadr's following, immense following, and this was a huge portion of the population. It wasn't some like, you know, terrorist sect or anything like that. And so things like that, and things like drone bombing community leaders in Afghanistan and Pakistan, and just these are what I call them unforced errors, that these are something that just, you know, someone with just common sense would know not to do. And so if they can't avoid those kind of errors, how can they avoid all the subtle problems that you really need, you know, really detailed local knowledge to address? So who's important in this community? What is the sectarian divide in this other community? What is the ethnic divide in this community? All these questions are really important, and military intelligence, they like to pretend that they're a quick study and that they can like master a region. But it's hubris, because they always fail, and so that's why, I mean, ideally, as I point out, it's best if there was no government at all, if it was just you know, individuals associating with each other and making arrangements with each other in order to provide security. But if there is going to be a government, it needs to be as local as possible, and so having planners in Washington dictate what's going on in through green zones in these occupied countries, what's going on in these Middle Eastern villages, that is just the exact opposite extreme.
Exactly right. I mean, again, this isn't just a problem for economics or for regime change and global intervention. It's a problem for all types of centralization, including everything that people believe they're voting for when they vote in president this or president that. So that it's truly the question of believing that one person or one group of people in the center of the universe can decide on everything and somehow calculate everything because they have perfect knowledge. It is a delusion, and it's a comforting delusion, I think, which is why people invest their time and energy in this, because it's much easier to just vote for alpha male leader A or alpha female leader B, rather than to actually commit to doing something about these problems. So Let's address that topic. If wars are not ended because of elections, or if fundamental policy changes don't take place through election after election, as we've seen from Bush to Obama, Clinton, they've all followed broadly the same foreign policies. What does actually change these things? What can people actually do that's more productive than just pulling a lever once every 4 years?
Well, my big argument is that what always ever makes social change, especially social change for the better, which what always creates freedom, the only way that we actually achieve freedom, not just in the future, but in the past, this has always been the way it works, it's not based on the virtue or ideology of the people in power, and that they are just so public-minded that they just bestow upon us our freedom. That's not the way it works. What happens is that every community, every group of people, they have certain red lines, and that if the government crosses these red lines, things get ugly. So it'll start off with evasion or civil disobedience, or it might escalate all the way to resistance. So you can think of just, you know, certain things that if the government would try to do in Texas, like if the government tried to, you know, confiscate Bibles and start burning Bibles in Texas, or even now in Colorado, if they started going around and you know, confiscating all the marijuana in Colorado, if the federal government started doing that, you know, there would be like real resistance to that. And the thing is that all governments depend on perceived legitimacy for their power. So this is a point that Ludwig von Mises, the great Austrian economist, would always make, is that ultimately it's not the guns that determine power. It's the ideology that determines which way those guns are pointed. And so in order for a government to stay in power, it in its own self-interest needs to know where those red lines are. It has no interest in crossing those red lines. It would much rather have the populace, you know, at least acquiesce to what they're doing. And so generally they try not to even get too close to the red lines, because it's hard to know exactly where the red lines are. And so what happens when there's an ideological change is that those red lines advance. People become less tolerant of certain kinds of depredations. And people in the government, if they know what's good for them, they'll notice those red lines advances. They'll see which way the winds are blowing, and then they'll back off. And that's what the so-called reform always is. It's not government suddenly being convinced by these great arguments and trying to fix things. It's people in government backing off because of a public change in sentiment about certain rights or certain issues. And so I'm not saying that, you know, what happens in Congress or the presidency doesn't matter. I'm just saying that people who want to make a change, they don't need to directly engage in the mechanics of what's going on there. All that needs to happen is to change the public ideology, and then careerists, self-serving careerists in the government will do the rest. It doesn't need our direct involvement.
The perception of legitimacy really is so important to this, and those red lines that you talk about are important. But of course, it's difficult for communities to draw red lines if they are being pitted against each other in this adversarial context every 4 years, the 2 minutes hate that people are engaging in, which is exactly why this really is an exercise in the exertion of power and power maintaining itself every 4 years. Just keep the public divided so that they can't create those red lines, so that then the whoever gets in has that perception of legitimacy and the mandate to rule, insofar as, well, there isn't a public united against that person. So it's extremely important to understand the underlying psychology of what's happening here and how this happens. I will direct people once again to your articles that we've mentioned today and your website in general, dansanchez.me, for more on this topic. Extremely important, one that we'll continue observing here at the Corbett Report, and I direct people to your website for more articles by yourself. Dan Sanchez, thank you very much for your time talking to us today.
Thank you so much, James. This is a great talk to you.
Now available from CorbettReport.com. The Data DVD Volume 4. Every podcast, interview, episode, and article published on CorbettReport.com in 2011, all on 2 Data DVDs. For details or to buy other Corbett Report DVDs, please go to CorbettReport.com/shop.